Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is Literary Viewpoints, and man, do we have a superb show today. We have New York Times author Robert DeGoni here, and he's going to talk to us about Detective Tracy Crosswhite, because she is really a unique crime solver, and she has her own specific way of doing things. So, leave it at that. And we're going to talk about his whole series. We're going to go from the beginning to the end. So, good morning, Robert. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm so glad you came on. So, could you give us an idea, a little background behind Tracy for the listeners?
Sure. You know, I wrote the David Sloan series, and about 3 years ago, I kind of wanted to do something different. I wanted to do more with of a police procedural with a cop, a police detective, and you know, Tracy Crosswhite is actually a minor character in my book Murder One. Mm-hmm. She's one of the police officers in that book, and I started looking at, you know, all the different characters, and I looked at her, and you know, found this kind of very interesting character of a woman who used to be a chemistry teacher in a small town that's become a cop, and talked about it with my agent, and she said, you know, well, what's her background? Why was she a chemistry teacher? And I said, you know, I really don't know. And we just started to explore it, and you know, I came up with this character, and she's really caught on with a lot of readers, and it's exciting. It's fun to write books about her.
Yeah, she's an interesting character. She's headstrong too. So she starts out in My Sister's Grave, then Final Breath, and now this one, In the Clearing. So My Sister's Grave is where she lost her sister, and that was
right.
The first one that I read. Oh, that was so sad. That was sad.
Yeah, she lost her sister actually 20 years before the start of My Sister's Grave. She lost her sister, her only sibling, when Sarah was 18 years old, and she's not convinced that the person in jail is the person that's responsible for her sister's mm-hmm. murder, and so it's really haunted her. For a lot of reasons. Unbeknownst to her, she was going to get engaged that night. Her boyfriend, Ben, was going to surprise her, and her sister was in on the surprise. They were leaving a shooting competition in Olympia, and the last words that her father, who was not with them, told her was to make sure her sister, you know, make sure they got home. And then Ben surprises her, and, you know, Sarah drives home alone and never makes it home. And, you know, 20 years later, they've never been able to find her or have any real, you know, real closure. And she received a telephone call from a detective up in Seattle who says, you know, we think we found a body in the hills above Cedar Grove. And sure enough, it turns out to be her sister's bones. And Tracy goes back home to kind of figure out what happened to her sister and why.
That is, I know, that's so sad. I lost my sister
yeah,
6 years ago, so, and we're still trying to figure out why. It's a hard thing,
I think for anybody that's lost, you know, someone they love, especially a sibling, I think it's a book that really strikes a chord with a lot of people.
Yeah, it was, and I, you know, I think I read it right after, and I'm saying it was a hard book to read, but it was something that, you know, you have to get through. And
Yeah, sure.
There are days I just talk to her up in the sky. I do, seriously.
Yeah.
And sometimes she, and I know when the sun shines bright, she hears me.
Yeah. No, I think you're probably right. I think that's very true.
Yeah. Tracy is committed to her job as a detective, and she likes to bring closure to her families. So why does she decide to take on a case that of what they think is suicide but really isn't, for her friend Jenny? Why does she decide to do that after 40 years?
Well, her and Jenny meet in a short story that I wrote called The Academy that's also out there, and it basically is one of the two stories I've written on how Tracy goes from being a school teacher in a small town to a homicide cop in Seattle. And, you know, she helps Jenny out a lot because Jenny's a young girl trying to make the academy. She wants to take her father's place. Mm. And she's her father's a sheriff in a small county here in Washington, down by the border of Oregon, called Klickitat County. And so 40 years later, Jenny goes down because her father, Jenny calls Tracy because her father, Buzz Allman, has died, and Tracy goes down for the funeral. And Jenny brings her into her home afterwards for the reception and pulls her aside and says, you know, I need to talk to you about something. And she pulls out this old case, 40-year-old case, in which this Native American girl was said to have committed suicide. But her father kept investigating it. And Jenny's convinced that her father didn't think that the young girl committed suicide and was trying to figure out what really happened to her. But for a lot host of reasons, you know, one, Jenny's not a detective, but two, Jenny's now the mayor of Klickitat County. She doesn't want to get involved because of, you know, potential politics and stuff. So she asks Tracy if Tracy will look into it. And, you know, I talked with some of my homicide detectives, and they said that, yeah, there are occasions where they'll do that. And so Tracy begins to look into the death of Kimmy Kanaskit and what happened to her the night that she disappeared. It's really important for Tracy to find closure for families because, you know, Tracy knows what it's like to go through, you know, years and years and not really have a full understanding of what happened to someone that you loved. And she knows the pain that comes with that. So it's one of her pet peeves. It's one of the things that she wants to, you know, to try to solve. And it was a fun case to write, but it was, you know, it's difficult when you're talking about somebody's, you know, somebody's loved one.
Yeah, it is. It's hard. It's really hard. I think that sometimes, the last book I wrote, it was fiction, but some of it was based on whatever I thought happened. So sometimes when you write it and you get it out, it doesn't make you feel better, but it sort of brings you closure in a different way, just to get your feelings. So she goes about getting the facts, and she meets Tommy Moore, and then she meets Kimmy's father and brother, and there's resistance there. They don't really want her to find out what happened.
Right. Well,
the brother gets angry.
The father and the brother, you know, I think people have to understand a couple of things. One is they're Native American. They belong to a tribe. And, you know, in Washington State, as in a lot of other places, the tribes weren't traditionally treated very well. And so there's that problem. And then there's the problem that, you know, they kind of, the county back then kind of blew off the investigation. You know, they kind of concluded very quickly, this is what happened. And, I mean, you know, you could imagine, you know, 40 years later, you know, somebody coming into your life and saying, I want to reopen this investigation because I don't think your sister committed suicide. And, you know, that would be tough. That'd be tough for anyone. But, you know, when you come from a nationality where you feel like, you know, the police kind of blew you off, didn't pursue the cases as much as necessary, you know, it's very hard on them. They're not aware that Jenny's father, you know, really kind of tried to pursue things and tried to find closure for the family, because the case had, you know, officially been closed by the county, and so, you know, for them it's old memories and it's painful memories, and they're not sure they want to open them up.
So when you write something like that about an investigation that happens 40 years ago and it comes back into the present, when you write that, do you write both scenes at the same time, or do you write the scenes that happened 40 years ago, because you're using two time periods, and then keep the plot flowing, so you keep it back and forth? How do you write that?
Well, it kind of differs. With this book, I, you know, I started writing, and Jenny's father, the former sheriff of Klickitat County 40 years earlier, you know, he was just a young detective. And he kept wanting to get in the book. You know, he kept wanting to tell his story of what happened. And so I started writing the scenes that, you know, that he was in, and you know, the background of him getting the call out and him going and pursuing the case, and you know, asking questions, and it became an effective way to tell, you know, make Kimmy much more personal, make her, you know, more than just a dead body. She becomes, you know, personal, and the case becomes personal to Buzz Almond, the father. And so I, you know, I started writing those scenes, and, you know, this book I was able to just sort of intersperse them, you know, where I thought was appropriate.
Mm.
But I have had other occasions, the book that'll be out next February, that I have finished and turned in, which is a Tracy Crosswhite book called The Trapped Girl. That was one where I actually wrote, I wrote pretty much the entire, you know, 50, 60 page background, kind of in one, you know, in one, you know, all together. And then I started interspersing it and cutting it and deciding what I was going to keep and not keep. So it just really depends on you know, how easily the story comes and how easily I can mesh the two together.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So I can't wait to read the next one. I knew there had to be more. I knew you weren't done with her yet.
No. And, you know, the next one, the next one kind of has a number of different storylines as well, including more of a personal storyline with Tracy and her boyfriend Dan. So, you know, just I'm just having a good time writing her. I think she's really been a fun character, and I'm working on a new one now. And so, you know, it's just going to keep going forward.
That is great, because I would be bored if a story book had only one plot for me to figure out. What can I say? I mean, it's, you know, two and three plots are okay. It's just that there's one author, and I won't say who, that wrote a book with about, I counted, 200 characters. And thank God he had a character outline in the front. Yeah. And then he had an awful lot of storylines that changed with each of the characters. So as an educator, I took out my graphic organizer, and I had to put my plot things and my character things, because I didn't want to mess up.
Because when
it gets to be too many, so like, you expect me to remember all of that? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And then sometimes when you're writing in different time periods, I mean, you're writing about an incident that happened, but I get, you know, different historical time periods, and I'm going, okay, let me look this up to make sure that I have it straight. Then I'll do the research based on it.
Or if
it's a small town, I'll look up and say, does this town really exist? Okay, let me see. So when the deputy sheriff promised to bring Kimmy home, or at least allow her family to know what really happened, why did he come up with obstacles from his superiors? Nobody wanted the truth to come out for some reason.
Well, you know, it was kind of a rookie mistake on his part to say that, you know, he was going to do this. It's something that police officers, you know, don't do, because they never know what they're getting themselves into and what's going to happen. So it was really more of a rookie mistake. And, you know, the pushback he was getting wasn't so much, you know, deliberate as it was practical. I mean, they believed that the case was closed. I mean, based on the forensics that they had at that period in time, based on the, you know, the kind of the ostensible factors of what was going on in this young girl's life, you know, they believed that she jumped in the White Salmon River, and that was it. And, you know, so it wasn't so much that there was, you know, resistance as it was that they just, there was, you know, they didn't see any evidence, you know, to the contrary. And, you know, again, he never believed it. He didn't believe it because he got, you know, kind of got into who Kimmy was more than just her nationality.
Mm.
And he just felt that it didn't seem to fit. What happened just didn't seem to fit. So he just started, you know, continue to pursue it.
Well, you have these four young guys, the four Iron Men they're called, and they won all the games. And everybody was into them more than they were into their lives. After a while, everything stopped. So why didn't anyone think to find out more about them?
Well, you know, again, you know, all over the United States, I think we put way too much emphasis on sports, and including high school football.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wanted to write a book where, you know, there was a couple of things where, you know, the mistakes you make in your youth can sometimes come back to haunt you. And so, you know, you had these young boys at this high school that, you know, traditionally wasn't a powerhouse, and they were, you know, exceptional athletes, and they had a new coach, and they were, you know, they were making a run for the state championship. And, you know, the town really got behind them and got into them. And, you know, I think like most things, you know, they're just these young 18-year-old boys that are out there playing football, and that's how the town perceived them to be, which, you know, in 99% of the cases is true.
Well, my favorite character, I have to tell you, but I don't know if you're bringing him back, is Sam Goldman.
I really
love this guy. I love this guy. So why does she need his help? And it just proves that people that are older people out there, they still got it. So what does he do?
Sam
that
is
he
a,
could, no one could do what he could do. I don't think anybody could do it in the whole world to even.
Sam's a former journalist, and actually Sam Goldman was my mentor growing up. He was my journalism instructor. And he was larger than life. You know, he was just larger than life. He was just a huge personality. And I wrote a book called The Seventh Canon, and it about 10 years ago. Sam Goldman was featured in it prominently as a San Francisco reporter, which is really what he was. And that book's going to be out actually in September of this year. You know, I wrote it as a book as a way to pay tribute to Sam. Because he was just such a great guy and had such a strong influence on my life. And I always told Sam that, you know, he was a character and I would someday make him a character in a book. And so I wrote this book. And unfortunately, Sam passed away about two or three years ago. And never got to really read, you know, what I had done. And so, you know, I needed a newspaper reporter in a small town who covered the stories that took place at that time. And, you know, I just decided I was gonna put Sam in the book, and I did. He does. There's a lot of people out there who will write me and say, you know, he's a great character. And you know, basically, he's just a guy that covered what happened in the town. You know, he covered
yeah,
the football games.
Yeah, but he's got some memory, though.
Yeah, and that's how Sam was in real life. Sam could remember things you couldn't believe. I mean, he remembered selling papers on the street corner when he was 12 years old. You know, the San Francisco Call Bulletin. And so Tracy uses him as a resource to find out what was going on at the town during the time that Kimmy disappeared, which, you know, police officers do all the time when they have a cold case like that, because they want to know what else was going on and what potentially is out there that they might want to take a look at.
Well, while she's working on this one, she's also working on the murder of Tim Collins. And that's an unusual case, because his wife claims that she killed him, and then her son claims the same thing, and I'm going like, this is getting really cool.
Yeah, again, kind of based on a true case that took place here in Washington, you know, because that's a difficult situation for a police officer, you know. I mean, what do you do when you have two people confess to the same crime? Again, it's a case that you know, has a lot of similarities. It doesn't seem like it on the surface, but has similar similarities to what's going on down in Clickitat County. Clearly somebody's not telling the truth, and Tracy's trying to figure out what really happened and why.
I know. And listening to the news, I worry about every police officer walking on the street. It's scary.
Yeah. It's sad and it's scary now. It really is. You know, there's always a couple bad apples in any profession that we have, and you know, those bad apples have done some bad things. And I was talking to the sheriff of King County the other day at a party, at a get together, and you know, he was very blunt about it. He said that, you know, the problem falls on us because we're the tip of the spear, and if we don't conduct ourselves in a way that's professional and appropriate, you know, we're going to get pushback. And he said, you know, African-American people in this country have had situations where they're, you know, they're treated poorly, they're treated wrong. And
that is, I know what you're saying.
You know, it's coming to a head. But, you know, at the same time, it's sad because, you know, a lot of these killings now, you know, the minute that it happens, I think people jump to conclusions. Without giving, you know, anybody a chance to really look into what happened. And, you know, more times than not, they look into what happened and, you know, the police acted justifiably. But, you know, that's getting lost, I think, in the uprising. And, you know, I think there's, like I said, I think there's a lot of validity to you know, what the African community is saying. And I hope that good
yeah.
things come out of it, because, you know, unfortunately right now it seems like things are just kind of a powder keg.
It's sad, because sometimes you don't know if it's just civilians that are going revenge and retribution, or if it's a terrorist attack. And there was something else that happened in Kansas yesterday, and it's just
I didn't see that.
Yeah, there were another couple of police officers that were hurt. It's scary. I mean, there was a crane that fell on the Tappan Zee Bridge yesterday that closed the bridge all day long. And my first thing was like, how could that happen and why did it fall? And it took all day for them. To figure out that it was just a plain old accident that happened, you know, mechanical accident. But you get to wonder, like, did somebody push it there? Did they want to hurt anybody? And they were lucky that nobody was killed. This is like crazy.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a scary time, you know. I worry about my kids, you know, who are just growing up. But when I was growing up, we had the Cold War, you know, with Russia, and then that kind of went away, and I was very blessed. You know, before that, people were dealing with World War II, and people before that were dealing with World War I, and so it seems like there's always something, you know, that makes it dangerous. And now, you know, we have international terrorism, and it's sad. You know, it's sad on a number of different levels. As a father, it's sad that, you know, I'd like my kids to be able to live in peace.
It's scary. It's scary. My nephews are not the same as me. They're different. And they tend to look at people as what they are and who they are, but they don't give them a chance to judge them for the kind of person they are. Me, I grew up in the South Bronx in a tough neighborhood. So to me, I grew up with everybody. So it doesn't dawn on me that anybody's going to do anything wrong. I mean, I walked out of the urgent care office the other day for something, and there were two guys sitting next to my car, and I said, I could either, you know, get upset, or I could just say, are you taking a picture of me, or are you taking a picture of your motorcycle? And he says, my motorcycle. I said, wait a minute, can I get in the picture with you? my husband looks at me and says, he says, you're too much. I go, you can't let people think you're afraid, because that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I'm 5 feet tall and very little. And I said, you know what? The guy thought it was cool that I thought his motorcycle was good, was gorgeous. So this is a novel about manipulation, illusions, images, and two cases where you want to know what is really happening, but there's like a smokescreen that's hiding both truths. That's how I see it. So
I mean, well, you know, as a mystery writer, that's what you're trying to do. You know, you're trying to have a number of different false trails, and you want to keep the reader interested. And the biggest question of all is, you know, who's telling the truth and who isn't, and what really happened. And you know, so as a mystery writer, I mean, that's what I try to do, is, you know, just try to keep people interested and try to keep them, you know, moving forward to what really happened.
Well, you did, because I picked up the book and I couldn't put it down until I was done. Which is a good thing for you, but a bad thing for me with my eyes. Oh, well. There are very few authors that I sit down and read like 400 pages in an hour and a half, and then I go back over it. As I read the book, I underline and circle and cross out and put little notes like, use this and don't forget to write something about that. So no one can read the book after me. Actually, my brother-in-law is going to get this one. Yeah, that I've got hands out for this. So why won't Jenny investigate the case by herself? I mean, she's wants Tracy and puts Tracy in danger. So why doesn't she want to do it?
Again, it goes back to the fact that she's the sheriff, and it was her father's case, and so she's worried that, you know, people in the town will think that she's on some crusade, and that she's, you know, got this, she's jaded by it, that she's pursuing something that really she has no business pursuing, and she's doing it just sort of to, you know, not to avenge, but just sort of to you know, on behalf of her father. And she knows that she won't be taken, you know, as seriously as someone as Tracy, you know, who's a seasoned homicide detective. And that's why Jenny doesn't want to personally get involved. She's already personally involved because of the fact that it was her, you know, it was her father that pursued it initially.
Do you think he would have wanted her to do it?
No, I don't think he would have for that very reason. And, you know, I think, most fathers don't, you know, even though she's a sheriff and she's very accomplished, I think, you know, most fathers kind of are like that, and that, you know, he wouldn't want to see his daughter, you know, put in a difficult situation. And, you know, it is a difficult situation that she's in. And so, you know, to have somebody like Tracy pursue it just makes it cleaner all the way around.
That's very true. You described the place where, you know, what happened to Kimmy and where she fell into the river. How were you
mm-hmm.
able to know exactly what the area looked like, and what kind of research into this did you do?
I drove up. I was in Portland at a conference, and you know, at conferences, a lot of times we'll have some downtime, and so I drove up from Portland, and it was about a 45-minute drive, if I remember, from Portland up to the kind of the border of Oregon and Washington, and I knew there were some small towns up there that I wanted to take a look at. I knew the White Salmon River ran through there, and so I just sort of started driving around, and I came to a town called White Salmon, and just started going into offices. Went into the newspaper office, went into the Chamber of Commerce, and just started reading, and went into the a breakfast place and sat down and just started talking to people. And you know, I knew I wanted it to be a small town. I knew I wanted it to be down that area. And then I walked the river. I walked a large portion of the river. The portion where they find the body really exists. Mm-hmm. And I went back upstream, and I came to a whitewater river office, and I knocked on the door, and there was nobody there. So when I went back, because it was winter, and so when I went back down to the Chamber of Commerce, I asked if, you know, they knew who owned it, and they did, and they told me his name and gave me his phone number. I said he was a great guy. I gave him a call and told him what I was doing, and just said, I want to know as much about the river as anyone could tell me. I figured a guide would know all about it, and he did. And in fact, he had been consulted on another book years ago, he said, and I just kind of started talking to him about, you know, where might somebody drop a, you know, or don't want to give away too much, but where might, you know, a body go in, and how would they find it, and you know, what would happen, and what happens when a body goes into the water, and does it submerge or not submerge, and you know, just he just was a really interesting man, and he helped me a lot. So I spent 2 days up there in the town, and I just you know, just started taking notes and talking to people, and unfortunately, the newspaper, the guy who runs the newspaper, wasn't there. And after the book came out, he called me. I was actually in Chicago at BEA, and he called me and said, you know, God, I would have loved to have met you, you know, but can I talk? Can we do an article on the book? And we did. So I wish I could have met him, but. It was interesting. It was a lot of fun.
That is great. It's hard because I walked up to it. Once again, my husband looked at me like, you didn't really do that. I was in the pizza place, and I don't eat too much of anything. And there was a police officer sitting behind me, and he just said to me, I don't know what dawned on him. He said, well, how was your day, whatever. And I said, how was yours? And he was going over to the train station because they beefed up security over there, he said, mm-hmm. and we were just talking in general. And I said, how do I get someone to be my police advisor on a book if I want to know how to, you know, a crime scene, and I want to make sure that I, you know, put the body in the right position or whatever. It's very hard up here.
Yeah.
He gave me the number of the march commander, and I had originally called the head of the fire department because I wanted to do something on arson. I wound up doing the research myself by looking it up. And obviously I was right, because no one said anything that I was wrong when they read my book. I have to read it, whatever. I once asked several of the authors, how do you know, you know, how to do a crime scene? And a lot of them, some of them have consultants, but a lot of them just look it up. But,
yeah,
you know, you're lucky when you get somebody
hard.
That opens up. Yeah, it is. It's hard.
If I wanted to
know how to... I asked my pharmacist before he left the profession how you poison somebody and what drug I would use if the person had this problem. So he gave me the hint, so I knew what to do. But
right.
Yeah, that I learned. You know, with medicines, it's easy. But I wouldn't know what to do with, you know, certain other poisons and toxics or certain weapons and stuff like that. So with respect to Angela Collins, she's an interesting character too. So she went in and said, I killed him. And her son went in and said he killed him, and you don't really know who killed him or why.
No, again, that's one of the, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, you know, things don't seem on the up and up,
yeah,
based on the physical evidence, but you don't really know what the ultimate outcome is, or why people are behaving the way that they're behaving. Whether they're just, you know, whether they are just trying to cover up a crime, or whether they, you know, are, you know, emotionally disturbed or anything like that. And so, you know, that's a, you know, something that, you know, it's hard, and that's something that, you know, Tracy's got to figure out, you know, how you go about, how you handle this. And, you know, I asked my police officers who are my contacts, you know, I mean, how do you handle a situation like that? And, you know, a lot of times in those kind of cases, which, you know, they call, you know, whodunits, a lot of cases for police officers are pretty straightforward, you know. Somebody shoots somebody and they're standing there holding the gun, you know, or you have a gangbang killing. When you have a situation like, you know, that I try to write about, you know, they're called whodunits because, you know, the police really don't know who the guilty party is, or they might have an idea, but they don't have the evidence to back it up. And really what it comes down to a lot of times for them is finding the evidence to support, you know, who really did do it. And, you know, hopefully you get the right person.
Now, this happened 40 years ago, and I'm not going to say who, how they figured out who did it, but can they actually arrest people after all this time? I mean, whichever ones they are there. They can? Murder has no statute of limitations?
Murder has no statute of limitations at all, ever. And that's why, you know, you have cold cases that are solved. We had a cold case here in Seattle that, you know, they thought they had solved, and it was 56 years old. And it turns out that the guy that they arrested, you know, now an 80-year-old security guard, I think he ended up walking. And I don't know if he was really innocent or if they just didn't have the full enough evidence to hold him. But no, a lot of times what happens is a case will get closed, but they never throw out the materials, never get rid of stuff if a case is still open, if it's still a cold case. And, you know, we've gotten much better at DNA analysis and things like that, forensics and all kinds of things. And so a lot of times what happens is, you know, it's no different than the doping scandals that, you know, you see happen in Olympic games you know, the bicycle riding, you know, say in the 1990s, you know, they're not equipped to test somebody's blood for a particular type of drug, and then, you know, 4 years later they are, and they test it and they find out that the person cheated. So they're able to go back, and that's what's happening with the, you know, the Russian athletic delegation now, is you know, they got caught for cheating, you know, 4 years ago during the Sochi Olympics. So it's the same thing with forensics. You know, a lot of times they'll have the material they need, but they don't have the ability to analyze it correctly. And then 4 years later, you know, things change. The DNA analysis changes, or they get more sophisticated at analyzing, you know, certain aspects of it, and they can get better results.
Yeah, but it gets dangerous for Tracy because they figure it out, but we won't say how. So when you finally realize what happened, and justice is finally served, do you really, she's gone, so do you ever really get justice? Do parents ever feel, well, that's great, now that I know who did it, I can move forward? Because it hurts no matter what you do.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to remember a quote that one of my homicide detectives told me, And I can't remember it, so I'm going to mess it up. But, you know, she basically said that is, you know, we can find closure on a case, but we can never find full closure for a family, for the very reason you just said is you know, the person's not coming back, you know, there's always going to be that hole that, you know, can't be filled, whether it's somebody's sister or somebody's daughter, or, you know, somebody's mother, or whatever the situation is. I mean, here in Washington State, we have a mother and a daughter that went on a hiking trip and never came home. They found them dead. And, you know,
that's horrible.
That's one of those things that you know, a family's never going to really recover from. And, you know, you just hope it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen to somebody you love.
Yeah, Paul Dorian wrote something like that in his last book, The Widower's Walk. Something like that. If a group of people, two people that came, didn't come home from a hiking trip, I think that's an interesting way to start a book, actually.
nobody knows exactly what happens out on that trail, and if there isn't any witnesses, then if there is witnesses, you know, you wonder,
yeah,
are they telling the truth?
That's scary. Even if they investigate, and no matter what, and sometimes I wonder if there's ever really, and I can't imagine that there could, but there could be, like, the perfect crime where somebody actually gets away with it. Can they have, a crime scene where there's actually no fingerprints, no forensics, nothing? Could that actually really happen?
If a person's, you know, very sophisticated. There was a murder out here years ago in which a U.S. attorney was shot and killed. And my understanding is they know who did it, but they just don't have the evidence to convict the person, and they probably never will.
Oh, wow, that's what's scary, because the person can be standing in front of you, and you know that they did this, and there's nothing you can do, and you feel helpless, and they're just looking at you like, "Ha, I got away with it." But you never know; someday they might slip up.
I come from that one of those backgrounds, though, that, you know, we never get away with anything. You know, we're always going to have to pay the price at some point. So
I never get away with anything. It's horrible now. so this novel deals with Tracy, with her relationship with Dan. But because she's doing all this, it kind of gets strained. So tell us about him. He's another interesting character.
Yeah, Dan's a former childhood friend who Tracy meets again when she goes back home to find out, you know, what happened to her sister. And she meets Dan, and he's moved back home after a divorce. And they begin to have a relationship, and a relationship develops. And over the course of three books, you know, they've become boyfriend and girlfriend. And, you know, Dan's a guy that just has a different perspective. He's, you know, he's early 40s. But he's, you know, he's divorced. He's moved away. He practiced law back in Boston, and now he's home. And I think, you know, he's been successful at what he does, and he's kind of just a guy that has a different perspective on life, and so he's much more easier. He's easier going than Tracy. He's much more calm. He's kind of her counterpart. And they balance each other out. But of course he worries about her. He worries that when she gets herself involved in these cold cases, that she's always trying to, you know, solve what happened to her sister or bring back what happened to her sister. And, so he just worries about her. He worries about her mental well-being, and he worries about her physical well-being, and he really loves her and wants her to be okay.
In a sense, I think she's doing this because she feels guilt about her sister. In a sense, I think she feels, because she didn't come to drive her home, that she's, it's her fault.
Right, right. No, very much so.
Not bad. Okay, before I forget, I don't really want to forget, the next show, unless something happens in August, I don't think so, is going to be September 13th, The Veritas Deception with Lynn Constantine. On September 22nd, Andrew Gross, One Man. That phenomenal book about the Holocaust, based on a true story that happened to his father-in-law during the war. 9:27, we've got Alan Jacobson, Alan Topo, John Land, and Stephen Schwartzley. We're going to talk about double plots and different timelines. On 10:05, we've got, I can't believe this, Lisa Unger and Ryan Moreland, and I'm hoping for Tasca Lee, so we could talk about how you write paranormal. And on 10:18, I am totally honored. Tess Gerrington and I are going to talk about, can't tell you, it's a secret. She wouldn't let me know. She told me not to say anything. And it's not about a book. It's something else. It's something exciting. And she came over to me and said, we have to talk. I go like, okay, I'm not going to say a word. So that's what's happening so far. And there are exactly 47 or 50 books inside waiting for my attention, and they're all going to wait for a while because, oh God. I've read some, other than One Man, I've read some very interesting books. The Elephant in the Room by Charlene Wexler, and I was very honored. She said she loved my review, so she's sending me 10 more books to read.
Wow.
Seriously.
Wow.
Yeah, I was like, oh my God. And Chicana is about an Inca treasure, and the author sending me, I think, 4 more that he wrote. And I was like, okay.
Wow.
But this book has an interesting title. And nothing grows in the clearing? How come? That was an interesting title, because I said I had to figure out what it meant, which I did.
Right. So 40 years earlier in this small little, or 100 years earlier, excuse me, in this small little town, they hanged a man. And as he was on the gallows, he said to them that he would rise from the grave and he would come back and haunt them.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, he did. And this is actually a true story that took place in White Salmon. When I was doing my research, I found it and just thought it was so interesting that I'd pursue it. So I took it a step further and put it in this clearing in the woods where nothing grows. It's just grass, and all around it is surrounded by trees. But for some reason, nothing grows in this clearing. And in the book, it's where they killed this guy. And of course, the legend is that nothing grows there because he died and what he said, and that he still continues to haunt this area. A more practical reason is if, they go back and I never really get into this too much, but it also could be a place where they dumped mining tailings that were pulled out of the hillside when they were doing mining, and the mining tailings are toxic, and so things won't grow there. So I just took some legend and played with it and created this area called In the Clearing. And my publisher loved it. Thomas Mercer loved it, and it became the title of the book.
When you use information from a book like that, or it's like a source or something, do you have to copyright it, or can you just, reword it and use it as you can?
No, I mean that's just a true fact. I mean it's no different than if you were just going to write about town, but that's a true fact that was reported in the papers back then, and so it's in the public domain, and it's fair game.
Well, I'll tell you, there's another character I almost forgot. I'm looking at my notes of 1,000 questions here. I love Kins.
Yeah,
are you going to bring him
Tracy's
back?
Partner.
I love him. I like him. I like him. Yeah, he's good.
Yeah, he's Tracy's partner, and so. More so than in the clearing. In the clearing, she's kind of off on her own quite a bit. But in the next book, Kins is again front and center with Tracy in this investigation to find out what happened to this woman that is discovered in a crab pot in the Puget Sound.
I can't wait to read that. You have to send it to me right away. I mean,
I
think the greatest thing is when I walk in to a medical office, or I'm sitting and waiting for an appointment, and I'm sitting with a book that says, and somebody says to me, is that out yet? I go like, no, I get it first. And it's like, no, you get it. It's like a couple of times. I mean, I was sitting with a few, and I like, it's not out yet? I go, no, it's not out yet, but it's really good. And then I walked into the elevator the other day, and somebody said to me, oh, could you recommend a few books for me? And they wouldn't let me leave until I recommended your book and if you wanted a whole bunch of others. And they're like, when am I the book? They call me the walking book reviewer in the building, and which is really great. So there was another thing. How did you find out about tire treads? How do you know the correct patterns in tire marks? Do you look that up, or did the police officers tell you?
No, I have a contact, a woman who, she calls herself a man tracker. She's actually a forensic person that they bring in to investigate a crime scene that's outside. And she can kind of, I used her first in Murder One. I was put in contact with her, and they can go in and they can look at they can go in and look at a crime scene. And based upon the footprints and the tire prints or what else is going on, they can figure out what happened and what when it happened and who stepped where first and how that all came about. So when I was putting this together, I called her up and asked, if the same were true of tire tracks and footprints and all that. And she said, absolutely. And so I had a long conversation with her sort of about how she would investigate the situation. and how she would review photographs, and really I put in the book the scene, you know, Tracy goes to her for help, but really it was the exact same scene for me. You know, I met her at a coffee shop that was sort of this eclectic coffee shop, and she just went through it and said, okay, here's what I would do, here's how the photographs would come into play, here's how I would review them, and I put that in the scene in the book.
That's amazing, because, you know, there's so many writers out there, and I've read, I think I lost count of how many thousands of murder mysteries, and I know yours are authentic, and I know that you have, you know, consultants, and yet I've read murder scenes where I'm saying, like, you got to be kidding me, that could never happen, or that could never happen, where somebody handed his wife the bones of the body from the dead, from the grave, and I said, like, they would never, chief of police would never let somebody hand in, swipe the bones from a body. Nor would the chief of police call in a retired cop to take over the case, because he couldn't do it. So
that's
it's amazing. I mean, you have ideas for different novels, and it's hard sometimes to get people. So what's next for Tracy? And is she going to go continue with Dan, or are you going to put somebody else in the mix here?
No. Her relationship with Dan will progress. I won't give anything away. But she's called out when a fisherman kind of accidentally discovers a woman's body in a crab pot in the Puget Sound, and there's a body of water out here, and they begin to look into it, and the question, you know, becomes, based upon the evidence they find, is this the same woman that was supposed to have disappeared a month earlier on Mount Rainier? And they sort of begin to delve into, you know, who is this woman, and how did she get in the crab pot? And, you know, they're in kind of jurisdictional disputes with people down in Pierce County, where, you know, where the woman they, you know, thought initially disappeared. And, of course, you know, nothing is as it seems. And the more Tracy gets involved, the closer she gets to, you know, to danger.
That is very true. Well, we can't kill off Tracy ever. No. Cannot do that. I got worried in this one and go, like, wait a minute, she's really in a bad fix over here. And then when she was in the water, I go, like, wait a minute, is she ever going to get out? I was getting claustrophobia, and my God, I felt like I was in there with her. That's how graphic the scenes were. I said, like, I could picture the clearing, and I could picture what happened to Kimmy. And I could picture Tracy in trouble, where she was in trouble, and I'm going, like, oh, my God, I can't breathe either. And it's like, that scene was fantastic, by the way. That was really good.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. Thanks very much.
If I could picture it in my little head. it's when they write, when you write a scene, and I'm saying, like, that could never happen, or so what? Which, you know, happens a lot. So will she ever get closure?
I don't know.
I don't know. Will she ever get closure from Sarah's death? Because I don't know if you really can. Or is it going to always haunt her, and is she going to always want to help people and bring back the, you know, bring them home?
Right. Yeah, no, I think, you know, I don't know. A lot of times I leave those questions open, you know, for the next book that I write, and I see what comes of it, you know, where that goes. You know, I didn't know that in the book The Trapped Girl, I didn't know how necessarily her and Dan's relationship was going to progress. But then as I wrote it, it became, you know, kind of much more apparent on how things would go. And, you know, I'm one of those writers where I have an idea what I want to write, but as I begin to write, things change, and I just kind of follow them.
Do you ever change the ending of a book after you write it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all the time. In fact, I kind of try to leave it open a little bit. You know, I work with my buddy Stephen James, who we teach a class together. And, you know, it's one of the things that he does is, you know, he says that if you know the ending to a scene, well, then you can't write that ending, because if you know the ending to that scene, then the reader does too. And, you know, so it's kind of one of those things. That's one of the fun parts is you know, I think I have an idea what's going to happen. And, you know, I just play it out. Just, you know, kind of
because you don't want the reader to figure out what's going to happen. And
yeah, no, definitely. You hope not. Or if they do figure out what's going to happen, you know, you hope that there's a nuance that they haven't completely figured out.
That is very true. I mean, I've read, like, I don't know how many books in the last couple of days, and I was surprised I actually figured out in the three of them. I go, like, oh yeah, I knew that, but in yours, I was going, like, huh? It was like a triple ending in your book. You know, what happens to this one? What happens to somebody else? What's the fate of somebody else? Are they going to... That was really good. It was like, oh, my God, a whole bunch of endings at the end. And no one's going to get it. They're not going
to
get it.
Well, I try to have, like I said, I try to have, you know, nuances and you know, things just you know, not completely, you know, not completely obvious to people or parents. So, thank you. I appreciate that.
No, it's not going to be apparent because I'm pretty good, I'm guessing. And I had a funny feeling about, you know, one. I won't tell you which one, but I said the other one was like, huh? It's amazing how you can do something. But it's amazing how people think till this day, you know, that you got away with something, and then they find out 40 years later you're not going to get away with it. That must really, you know, shock the person. Now, what would happen if they figured out, oh, my God, I'm going to get caught, and then they disappear? Would they find them?
Oh, you'd hope, you know. You'd hope. I think with today's technology, it's a lot harder to disappear. You know, I think back in the day, you know, 40 years ago, we didn't have, you know, the ability to track people the way we do now. But now I think it's pretty hard to get away now. You know, You think of a bunch of cases that you know, where people have tried to run, and it's hard to run, and you know, it's very hard to run now. They just have so many different ways to track you.
Yeah, I had a show 3 weeks ago on I did one on the Paris murders, the Brussels murders, and we've done one on terrorism with an FBI agent, and we were talking. It was really funny. It wasn't funny. It was right before the murders at the airport, and I'm like, oh my God, we talked about the fact that you can't always stop everything, and that's what's really scary, because you know, you have all the security at an airport, and you have all these people as you're walking in, you know, to make sure that there's nothing there, and yet these people walk right into the airport and killed everyone. And
terrifying.
It is terrifying, which explains why I would rather walk than right now. I don't go on planes too often, and now you have to worry because of what happened in Germany with the trains. ISIS got them. So, would you ever write anything about terrorism? Because they're not in your books, which is probably why.
Yeah, I don't know.
I like them.
That's kind of a different niche, yeah. And you know, I'm not. It's not something that I have found the desire to pursue at this point, but you never know.
So before we end, where can everybody learn more about you, your work, and your series, and are you writing another David Sloan?
So everyone can kind of find me on the internet. I mean, I have a web page. It's www.robertdegoni.com. I'm on Facebook, Robert Degoni, and Twitter. My publisher, Thomas and Mercer, you know, has a page for me. And if you go on Amazon, there's a whole page of all the books that I've written if you just put my name in. And that's usually the best. And I have a newsletter people can sign up for on my webpage. And I don't spam people, but I do try to update them on, you know, what's coming out next and when it's coming out. Those are usually the best ways. David Sloan, I don't know. There was a lot of factors in me moving away from David Sloan. I like David, but you know, one of the problems is that he's the David Sloan franchise is really owned by two different publishing companies. It started at Hachette, and then it was owned by Simon & Schuster, and there's a whole bunch of nuances involved in that. And so, you know, I'd love to bring him back at some point, but at this point I'm just having a lot of fun writing the Tracy Crosswhite books, and so I'll see where those take me.
I like Thomas Mercer, and I don't have to ask for the books. They just send them.
They've been great with me.
They just send them. I don't even have to ask. I just get them in the mail. Like, I never know what's going to happen. I go like, oh, my God, another one? Meryl Morris is the publicist that work with them, and I get them like, oh, my God, another one, another one, another one. So, I don't even question it anymore. They just email me, when are we getting the review? I go, like, in about 20 years. Don't worry about it. They'll sign me up for a blog tour, and they'll go, like, but you have to wait till June of next year, though, you know, for me to read the book, because it's going to take me forever.
Right.
But I don't my husband says to me, so you don't learn to say no. I go, well, you know, there are authors out there, and I feel that maybe my review is going to help them, or maybe what I write, or maybe something that I'm going to do is going to make them sound better, but I won't pan a book. If I don't like the book, I just won't review it, or I won't post it on Amazon or Goodreads. I'll just post a, you know, like a cursory review. So when did this one come out?
In the Clearing?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking about? Yeah, In the Clearing came out in May.
In May, okay. I think I posted my review. I'll post it again later. I'll post it again later on Facebook because everybody, it's amazing. I post my reviews on my review site, which is just reviews, and I post it on my review site and on Facebook. I have a whole bunch of them just for the reviews, Fran Lewis's reviews or whatever. And 5 minutes after I post it, there's 20 people that have already read it.
Oh, that's great. It's great for you and it's great for me as an author.
It's scary. Yeah, they do for some reason. Oh, that's a great review. Oh, whatever. And comments, like I need a whole, on my Just Review site, I get a lot of people that just, you know, would follow me or whatever. I have no idea why, but they do. But the book that's coming out in September, am I going to get that one?
Yeah, you should.
Good. Yeah, that would be something different. Yeah. That would be great, but thank you so much. Oh, my God, this has been great. I love this book, and I could see my cousin's hand is out for this one. She's not getting it, yeah. my family loves me, Robert, because I don't buy books, and they say, you know, who do you have and what are you reading? So when I actually told them who I was interviewing today, they go, yeah, I know who that is. They go, like, you're kidding me, finally. Because I don't think anybody reads it anymore. But when I said, Robert, you're going to go, oh, excuse me. So I'm looking forward to reading the next one so we could set up another interview for the next one. And
thank you. I look forward to it.
Everybody have a nice day. It's a beautiful day outside. It's not going to rain until later. And if it does rain, take out a book and read because that's what I do to relax, and I'm so happy to do it. Have a nice day, everybody, and bye.